Come to look at our passage this morning from John chapter 20. And the theme is this, it's does it ring true? The passage is about Thomas and about the fact that he doubted that Jesus was alive. Now here's some famous people of a certain generation. And I wonder what they might have in common, okay? There's Sir Paul McCartney, there's Cher, Carlos Santana and Robert Redford. The thing they've got in common is this. Over the last so many years, there's been stories and news that they've all died. And they hadn't. It must be quite a relief, isn't it, to read the newspaper and think, well, that's not true. These are fake news deaths. And there's a lot of it, if you look on the internet, there's a lot of it about, you see things and think somebody's died. Is that true? And it's not. And these days, there's ways we can measure all sorts of things. We can measure electricity, speed, time, all sorts of distances and things. But there's actually now a way you can measure believability, if you can believe that. It's called the MBS 12, invented by a guy called Rob Yale in America. And if you hear a story, there's various lists of questions you can ask to see if you think it's true or not. But basically it boils down to this, does it ring true? In your experience, looking at the story, do you think it tallies with what you understand? Now, in the passage we're about to read, Thomas was told Jesus is alive, and for him, it just didn't ring true. He had this gut feeling that this wasn't a true story, that Jesus wasn't alive. Now, as you know, we're all already sick of hearing about the general election. We'll hear about it again and again and again over the next few weeks. But when I was preparing this, I remembered, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, a long time ago, there was Liverpool's had a leader called David Steele. Remember him? And he's still around, I believe. And he famously made this speech at a party conference just before an election. He said this, "Go back to your constituencies and prepare for government." Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out at that time. But this is what Thomas had been preparing for, if you think about it. He'd come to Jerusalem with the disciples. It was against his better judgment because he didn't think it was a good idea to go to Jerusalem. And he was right, it was quite a dangerous move. But when they turned up at Jerusalem and all the people were welcoming them and saying, "Hail the King," he must have been thinking to himself, yes, maybe this will happen. Maybe there will be a government. Maybe the Romans will leave and we'll have a government and Jesus will be our King. He might have thought, despite the fact that Thomas had quite a hard edge to him, he must have thought, well, just maybe this is going to work out. But then, of course, as we know, as the week passed, people rejected Jesus. He was betrayed. He was executed. And let's not forget, this was humiliating. This was humiliating for Jesus because to be crucified is the most humiliating death there is. You're there on a cross, you can't hide. It's a very public, humiliating execution. But let's not forget, it was also humiliating for the disciples. They followed this man all the way to Jerusalem and to come to this. They were humiliated. So Thomas had been on this roller coaster ride. And when somebody says to him, well, it's all right, Jesus is actually alive, you can understand why he was a bit cynical about it. Let's have our reader up. Let's read our passage this morning.
The reading is from John chapter 20, verses 24 to 31, and we found on page 1089 of the Pew Bibles. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. That the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have seen life in his name. This is the word of the Lord.
It's an amazing passage, isn't it? So Thomas, it's funny, some of the disciples we know a bit about. We don't know much about Andrew, for example. We know he's a fisherman. We We don't know a lot more really than that. But Thomas, Peter, and a couple of the other disciples, we know got a little bit of a handle on them. We know that Thomas traditionally is the doubter. It's funny that Thomas's legacy has been this thing of being a doubter. And today we still say, oh, you're a doubting Thomas, don't we? You heard that in the news and people around you say that. But we don't say, oh, you're a bit of a big mouth Peter, do we? We don't say things like, you're a bit of a pull yourself together James, do we? It's just Thomas has been singled out. Now, if you think about it, he was a bit cynical, but he was also kind of a realist. He took a different view on things. In John chapter 11, when Jesus told the disciples, right, we're going to Jerusalem, the disciples were like, yes, let's go. And Thomas was there, and he was like, we're going to die. That's what he was still saying. He literally said, we're going to die. He knew the dangers ahead. And then when they got to Jerusalem, and they're in the upper room, Jesus talks about going to a place. He's talking about heaven, isn't he? In my Father's house, there are many mansions. Jesus talks about going to heaven. And he says, you know the way to get there. And the disciples were all like, yes, yes. But it's Thomas who says, well, actually, no, we don't know the way. What are you talking about? Thomas was like that. And in a way, in churches, we need people like Thomas, don't we? We need people to say, well, wait a minute, what does this mean? What do we do about this? It's good to have people who get real with God. Because, for example, if we said, well, we're going to knock on every door in the world. You need someone to go, well, wouldn't people get fed up with that, wouldn't they? Or wouldn't that take an awful lot of time? Or things like that. You need people who are going to sort of bring a bit of reality into it. Because Thomas hasn't stopped liking Jesus, has he? Thomas hasn't stopped worshipping Jesus and thinking that Jesus is great. He just needs Jesus to be real. He's heard all these whispers about Jesus being alive. He wants Jesus to be real, either real or nothing. That's Thomas. I remember there's a Christian preacher I heard who, when he was starting out in the faith, very young, he'd just become a Christian. He was on fire for God, and he had several brothers, and one of them drowned in an accident. It was a terrible tragedy. And he was left shouting out to God, God, I need you to be real to me. It's okay to pray that prayer. That's exactly the prayer that Thomas prayed, isn't it? He said, Jesus, I need you to be real. I don't need to hear whispers. I don't need to hear rumors. I want you to be real. And that's the prayer that Thomas prayed, if you like. He said, I need Jesus to be real. I need to see him. But it's okay, because sometimes our lives don't go in the way we expect. We think God's taking us this way, and we end up going this way. And these are the times when it's okay to say to God, look, what's going on? I need you to be real. I need to have that real conversation with you. So that's Thomas in this passage we're looking at. What about Jesus? Jesus comes in the middle of this passage. He appears. I wonder, how can you tell when things are genuine? For things like gold, remember in the old days people used to bite gold, didn't they, to see if it was soft enough, to see if it was the right sort of metal. With diamonds, evidently, I've never seen a diamond that big, by the way. But evidently, if you look through a diamond print on a page, it's cloudy and dark. And that's how you can tell it's a real diamond. With silver, it often has a hallmark. Have you ever seen this on silver before? Has anyone seen that on a plate, a silver plate or a cup? No. It's a mark on the silver to show where it was made, when it was made, who made it, and that the silver is authentic. It's called a hallmark. And we use that for all sorts of ideas of genuineness, authenticity. And these days, people want the real thing. They want real things. If you go on holiday, people want the real experience of the place they're going to. People want the real ingredients in the food. People want the real deal. And that's a big thing today of authentic experiences. When Jesus appeared in the room to Thomas, he was bearing the hallmark, wasn't he? The hallmark of his realness was on his hands to show that he was the real Jesus, the real Jesus. And for a moment, I'm going to put on my evangelist's hat, okay? And I'm going to say this. If you're here this morning, you don't know Jesus. If you're looking for something that's the real deal, Jesus is the real deal. He's very, very authentic. If you're looking for an authentic spiritual experience, then come to Jesus. If you're looking for a holy man, if you're looking for the Son of God, if you're looking for that ultimate spiritual religious experience, you don't need to look no further than Jesus, because Jesus is the real, real thing. Jesus has the hallmark of authenticity on his hands to show that he is the real thing. Now, when Jesus came back and appeared to Thomas in the passage, he rang true, didn't he, to Thomas? Thomas instantly knew that this was Jesus and that he'd been wrong. He instantly knew that Jesus was real. When Jesus appeared, he could have asked for a shiny, new, fantastic body. Goodness knows I would have. One with hair, perhaps a bit thinner. Jesus could have asked for a new body, couldn't he? A new form to be in. But he didn't. Jesus chose the body that had died that painful death with the holes in it, didn't he? Jesus chose that. Now here's a bit of a mind-blowing thought. Please bear with me, but see if you can follow me with this one. Okay? Jesus has existed from the beginning of time, from before the beginning of time. Jesus will always be with us right to the end of time. Jesus is eternal, yeah? He's forever. And right in the middle of this eternity is Jesus' experience on earth. We think life goes on forever, doesn't it? We think that every day drags sometimes. But we're just a tiny bit in the middle of eternity. And the Jesus, after his experience on earth, in eternity part two, has got these marks on his hands. Jesus is marked for the rest of eternity. But he's happy to wear that as a badge of honour. It's quite an amazing thought, isn't it? Verses 26 to 29 says this. This is the heart of the passage, really. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand, put it into my side, stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus told him, "Because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." This is another example in the Gospels of Jesus kind of throwing things back at people, isn't it? I think Jesus would have been a really good tennis player because he could return any serve given to him. He'd be like, back at you. Whatever people said to Jesus, he could return it. When people said to him things like, when Pilate said, you're the king of the Jews? Jesus said, "Well, that's what you say. What do you think?" When a guy who had an ill son said to him, "Look, if you're willing, you can heal him." What did Jesus say? "If I'm willing, of course I'm willing." Jesus kind of throws it back at people. Good teacher, why do you say I'm good? What do you mean by that? He starts from where we are. That's what he does to Thomas, doesn't he? He says to Thomas, "Put your hand in my side, feel my hands." He's kind of starting where Thomas is at. He's using the words that Thomas used back at you. Not in a nasty way, he's using it almost like in a playful way. And it made me wonder, what would he do to us? What would he say that we say and throw it back at us in a friendly, playful way? Now, quite recently, has anyone here got a catchphrase that they're aware of that they say all the time? Perhaps we're not aware. Sometimes it creeps up on us and it's quite, "Oh, right, I didn't know that." A couple of weeks ago, I was chatting with our youngest son, Aidan, and I was tired and he said something and I just went, "Oh, fair enough." And he said, "Dad, don't you fair enough me." And I thought, do you know, I say that a lot. It's a dismissive thing, you know. And we all have, we might not realize it, we have catchphrases that we use. And Jesus always takes things people say to him and sort of feeds them back to them and says, "What do you mean? Tell me about that." And we say it as Christians as well, don't we? And it's a fatal thing to say. Things like this. "We tried that before, it didn't work. What about this one? This is the worst. You never catch me doing that. You never catch me dancing in church. You never catch me raising my hands." It's a fatal thing to say, because God, being very ironic, will sometimes turn it round on us in a playful, funny sort of way. But how does this show us that Jesus is authentic? How does this show us that Jesus is the real deal? Because when he says he loves us, he starts from where we are. He starts from where we are. He doesn't sort of say, "I love you, oh, you're great," you know. He starts from where we are. He starts with the words that we say and moves on from there. Jesus' love rings true because he starts from where we are. Do you know that song, isn't it? "You did not wait for me to draw near to you." It's about Jesus coming to us. Jesus came to earth because he wanted to start from where we are. And that's how we know he's authentic. That's how we know when he says he loves us, he really, really means it. So that's Jesus in the passage here. Now the last bit is John speaking. But if you remember, the last bit of the passage is about John kind of wrapping up. And it almost feels to us like this is the end of the gospel. If this was a movie, you'd hear the music building up and there'd be credits coming, you know, and it'd be the sunset and all this stuff. What does John say? These things were written that you might believe. But I'm glad it's not the end of the gospel. I'm really, really glad. Because otherwise we wouldn't have chapter 21. What's special about chapter 21? If you know John, and I recommend John to you, it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book of the Bible. In chapter 21, what happens? Peter is reconciled with Jesus. What's big about that? So what? Jesus came to life. All the disciples were amazed, especially for Peter. Because what had Peter done just before? He denied him 3 times. In chapter 21, Peter's given 3 chances to say to Jesus that I love you. Isn't that amazing? And it's a good example of what I'm just saying, isn't it? Jesus starts where Peter's at. He doesn't expect Peter to be anything more or less. He starts where Peter's at, and that's how Jesus deals with us. And that's how Jesus expects us to deal with other people who aren't Christians. When you witness to people, don't just start with... I remember a few years ago, a friend of ours had this booklet. Do you remember Rob had that booklet? And he said, if you have this booklet, you'll convert people. You start on page 1, you have this conversation, it automatically goes through the booklet, and by page 7, they're on their knees praying. It doesn't work like that. Nothing simple. We need to start, when we're witnessing people, we need to start where people are at. We need to start where people have problems. We need to start where people have questions. So chapter 21, Jesus brings Peter back in, and that way he does, a starting where we're at, a starting where Peter was, where the problems that Peter had, with the guilt that Peter had. So that's chapter 21, but John is drawing this chapter to a close, and it feels like the end of the gospel because he's kind of bringing it all together. He's saying, these things are written that you might believe, because even Thomas believes now. Even Thomas is a believer now. Even Thomas has accepted that Jesus is alive. So it's almost like a good place to end the story. He says this then, it's written that you might believe and have life in his name. But what does that mean? It's one of these Christian phrases. Jesus came to bring us life. What does that mean in real terms? In John chapter 10 it says, as I've come to bring life in all its fullness. What does that mean in the real world? I don't know if you can remember, a long, long time ago, it was a TV series called The Good Life. It was just a silly comedy, sitcom set in suburbia about a couple who decided to go against the grain. Do you remember that? And it made me wonder what the question, Jesus wants us to live the good life. What does that mean in real terms? Because if we're living the good life, we're not always good, are we? We don't always get things right. And life isn't always good to us either. But what it means is this, Jesus wants people to see how real he is in us today. That's the good life. Now, I went on the internet to see what people who aren't Christians understand by the good life. What does it mean to be living the good life? And this is what they said. Here's the first thing. The good life is when you feel you have a life story you want to share with others. That's a non-Christian saying that. So sharing our faith, being real, when our faith rings true, what does that look like? It means when we're a blessing to people around us, doesn't it? Not just that we say things, but our lives are a blessing. We share the blessing God has given us with people around us. That's what it means to be living the good life, to be living a life that rings true, have a faith that rings true in our lives. So it means visiting people who nobody else visits. It means making friends with people who people ignore. It means sharing things that we've got with people. That's when our faith rings true. Here's another thing people say about the good life. What does it mean to have a good life? The good life is when the future, this is non-Christian, don't forget, when the future looks better than the past, when the present feels good to be in. I'll say that again. When the future looks better than the past, and when the present feels good to be in. Well, we've got a hope, haven't we? And what a hope. Our future looks better than our past. One day, we're going to meet the risen Jesus, just like Thomas did. Isn't that amazing? Have you thought what you're going to do when that happens? You're going to look at the holes. You're going to look away. You're going to feel ashamed. It's nice to think about these things, isn't it? We speculate on what we'd do if we win the lottery, which is sort of zillion to one chance. But we don't think about the things that's definitely going to happen. And that's one of the things. If we believe in Jesus, we're definitely going to have him. We're definitely going to meet him face to face. It's good to think about things that are definite, isn't it? In verse 29, Jesus said this famous bit, isn't he? Blessed are those who do not see but believe. Well, that's the good news there, because that's us, isn't it? We haven't seen Jesus in the flesh, but we believe. Does that mean our faith is better than the disciples? It's a good question, isn't it? I don't know. Some ways, maybe not others. Because we live in a very different world from the disciples, don't we? We live in a world where everything's now, instant, isn't it? But Jesus doesn't think like that. Jesus thinks in eternal terms. He thinks from the beginning, from before the beginning of time to the very end of time after that. That's how Jesus thinks. And the Bible is full of forever truths, isn't it? It's not just truths for now or here's something for now. It's forever truths. Do you ever feel like our faith doesn't ring true? That we do things that go against how we should be as Christians? We try and try, but we can't seem to project Jesus in our lives. I want to just close with this thought. We don't need to project anything. We just need to reflect Jesus. Our lives may not always ring true, but Jesus is so real, so true, that even a dim reflection in our lives is dazzling glory to the world around us. Even though our lives are imperfect, even though we're not good mirrors, the reflection of Jesus is so strong and pure and holy and lovely and true that his reflection in our lives is dazzling to the world around us. As the world around us gets darker, which let's face it, it is, then Jesus will shine more through us as we reflect him. And we have a hope that rings true, haven't we? When we're in Jesus, we have a hope that rings true. Because one day, we will see Jesus face to face. And that's a definite. That's not a maybe, that's a definite. Our future looks better than our past.